KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
It's the right thing to do for the economy, and it's most importantly the right thing to do for American families all across the country.
It's fun to start greens indoors because then you can plant the greens in patterns.
In order to understand what the end is, this thing that we are always talking about, coming apocalypse, I wanted to kind of break it apart and say, well, it's not quite what we think.
Writer Craig Childs takes us to places where seas boil and ice melts for a tour of the apocalyptic planet that he writes about. We're going to talk about gardening with our guests and some harvests as well. And you heard at the top, President Obama on the payroll tax cut that was put in place in 2011. We're going to take that up today on Weekday on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scher. A temporary reduction in the Social Security payroll taxes is due to expire at the end of the year. Hardly anyone in Washington, D.C. is pushing to extend it. Now, why is that? Social Security is funded by a 12.4% tax on wages up to $110,000. That'll rise to 113 in 2013. Half is paid by employers. The other half is paid by workers. For 2011 and 2012, Congress and President Obama cut the share paid by workers from 6.2% to 4.2%. So a worker making $50,000 saved about $1,000 a year or more, about $19 a week. A worker making $100,000 saved $2,000 a year. Under the law, Congress is supposed to be reimbursing Social Security for the lost revenue. Estimated at $103 billion in 2011, $112 billion in 2012. That's since there was no other place where Congress raised taxes or cut spending. That is looked at as being financed with borrowed money. So what happens now? Brian Kessler is an economist at Moody's Analytics. He joins us on the phone. Brian Kessler, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
What was the purpose of the payroll tax cut? You heard what President Obama said. Who benefited?
Well, I think there's the immediate benefit that goes to about 160 million American workers. They get, as you mentioned, somewhere between a couple hundred to as much as $4,000 for a couple filing jointly back into their pockets in sort of small increments throughout the year. And so it's a benefit to them. And I think the idea behind it is that that provides a benefit to the economy as a whole. And so that money back in the pockets of individual families will circulate back into the economy through improved consumption.
Is there any evidence it did?
I don't think that there have been studies that have been done specifically on this payroll tax, and there are a lot of people that argue that it hasn't had an impact or that it hasn't had enough of an impact. I think the reports that came out from J.P. Morgan recently, where they sort of played out what would happen if the payroll tax was allowed to expire, provide some evidence that they think it did have a pretty significant impact. But no, we don't have any direct evidence that says how large that impact was.
And what was the assessment of what would happen if and when this payroll tax cut expires?
So the people at J.P. Morgan Chase, the investment bank in New York, released a report a couple days ago basically saying that if the payroll tax cut is allowed to expire next year, that it's going to reduce economic growth by 0.6% next year, which is pretty large. You consider estimates for next year's growth are going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2%. So a 0.6% drop is pretty serious.
Have you looked at all of how that would compare if the Bush tax cuts on higher income earners was dropped?
Yeah, I think that's considered to be quite a bit larger than the drop from the high-income tax cut. So what we're talking about in budgetary terms is pretty similar. You're looking at something like $100 billion over the course of a year. And the question then comes down to how does that filter back into the economy? And I think the position at J.P. Morgan, and it's pretty broadly held by my boss, Mark Zandi, people at CBO and other who have looked at this, is that tax cuts that go predominantly to people towards the top tend to have a smaller impact on the economy than those that target lower and moderate income families.
So if the Bush tax cuts expired, maybe I didn't ask my question right. What happens if the Bush tax cuts expire? So it's the same basic impact on the economy?
If you're saying for incomes above $250,000 a year, my estimation would be that the impact would be smaller in letting the Bush tax cuts expire than the payroll tax cut.
Smaller in terms of its impact on growth?
That's right.
I see. Does a lot of people who are talking about letting this Social Security payroll tax break expire say that it has endangered Social Security? How does it endanger Social Security?
Yeah, so the concern here is that it reduces confidence in the Social Security program. You mentioned in your introduction when the original payroll tax cut was passed back in 2010 and when it was extended in 2011, part of the law stipulated that funding to the Social Security Trust Fund must be replicated must be backfilled from general revenues. And that has in fact happened. So in terms of actual the balance sheet of Social Security, there hasn't been any change as a result of this law. The concern that many have expressed, and AARP is one of these, is that by taking away the traditional link between people's payroll taxes and the Social Security benefits that they're going to get later in life, you weaken the perception of the program as something that's sort of separate from the rest of the debate. I don't really buy into that argument personally. I think this has been going on for 2 years, and whether that is a 2-year period or a 3-year period, I don't think qualitatively changes the perception of Social Security. The concern I think that AARP underlines, and they sent a letter to Congress recently expressing their opposition to an extension of the payroll tax cut. What they say is that it must be temporary, and I think that's pretty much consensus, that it should be a temporary cut. And the question is, should it be temporary for the 2 years that it's been there, or perhaps for one more year?
Because of its impact on economic growth.
That's right. I think the conditions that we were under when this was extended in 2011 we're not much better off now. We're not significantly higher growth or significantly higher monthly job creation than we were at that point. And so the same rationale that existed in early 2011 exists today, which is we want stronger growth. We want more consumption. We want more job creation. And so allowing this tax cut to expire, reducing disposable income by something like $125 billion next year is probably not the best move right now if we're looking for economic growth.
Now, I know you're an economist at Moody's Analytics, Brian Kessler, and not a political analyst as well, but why so little support from Democrats or Republicans to extend this payroll tax cut?
Yeah, that's a tough call. I think probably a big part of it is the position that AARP has taken now in the months leading up to the election. AARP represents a pretty significant chunk of Americans and some pretty reliable voters. And so when they say that this shouldn't happen, that's something that I think politicians on both sides of the aisle listen to. The opposition among Republicans on this is pretty well documented. I think in terms of Democrats, I think there was a perception among a lot of people that this was going to not be necessary for a further extension. If you'll recall back to the debate that happened in 2010, we had originally had in the Making Work Pay tax credit that was part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus bill from 2009. That was a short-term tax cut that was targeted towards lower and moderate-income families. That was allowed to expire due to strong Republican opposition. And this payroll tax cut was put in as sort of a replacement for that that was seen as sort of a little riskier, a little less effective than the original tax cut. And I think the idea was to have it have expired at this point. And so I think this year, probably starting around this summer, you're starting to hear from a lot of Democrats that were saying we should allow this to expire. People like Nancy Pelosi, Majority Leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi.
Minority Leader now.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner were saying this is sort of needs to be allowed to expire. More recently, you're hearing from people that are on the Democratic side who are saying that it should be extended. So the ranking member on the House Budget Committee, Chris Van Hollen, has recently said that this should be part of the negotiations that go along in the fiscal cliff discussion at the end of the year. And the former director of the National Economic Council, Lawrence Summers, has also said that, it's key that this be kept in. So I think it has been expected to and sort of assumed to expire by Democrats and Republicans for most of this year. And it seems like the tide is shifting a little bit on that perception.
Boy, if they extend the Bush-era tax cuts for everybody and they extend the payroll tax cut, we still are looking at people talking about cutting taxes but not finding ways to either raise revenues or make big cuts in spending in other places while they get to that fiscal cliff. So it's negotiating cards.
Yeah, and I think that reminds us of the purpose that there's a fiscal cliff to start with, right, is that the opposite side of this is the question about deficits and the national debt. So up to this point, we've been talking about the impact on the economy. There's also the impact on the budget deficit for next year. So, you know, when we're talking about the adding $100 billion or $115 billion to the deficit next year in order to extend this. And in terms of the higher-end Bush tax cuts, you're talking about another something like $100 billion being added on there. You know, that could potentially push us back up over $1 trillion. That would be the fifth year of $1 trillion deficits next year if that was allowed to go forward. So there is a cost to all of this, obviously.
And that's what we keep looking at, the cost of all this and how it relates. I appreciate you putting in perspective, Brian Kessler.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Brian Kessler is an economist at Moody's Analytics, taking a look at the Social Security payroll tax cut that is set to expire at the end of the year and whether it will be extended. This is Weekday.
On one fateful night in 1938, thousands of men and women ran from their homes convinced that Martians were invading. All because of a radio play.
But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear.
Okay, were we really so unsophisticated back then? Could the War of the Worlds happen again? Here's a hint, yes. We'll find out on the next Radio Lab, where we'll come to you.
Live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And that comes your way Friday night at 7 o'clock. Good morning, it's 10:16. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
We have cloudy skies and 48 degrees in the University District, working towards a high today of 51. Forecast calls for clouds and showers. There's also a chance of thunderstorms and hail a little bit later today. Clouds and showers tonight, chance of thunderstorms and hail as well, the low near 40. Clouds and showers expected tomorrow, the high reaching 51.
By the way, Katie Sewell in our radio retrospective series will take a look at the War of the Worlds impact, and it's on radio and on the culture. That's on Thursday. Humans have been on the Earth for just a few scant millions of years, but we're having some profound impacts as well. Over the billions of years the Earth's been around, it has seen continents rise and fall, seas dry up, mountain ranges wear away. Extinctions have happened at least five times. We may be on the cusp of another. Humans weren't around for the others, but we might be getting a front row seat for turning the planet, for a turning point in the planet's history, that is. Front row seat, heck, we're right on the stage, aren't we? Climate change is a human-induced, sped-up version of the interplays of the planet's natural systems. Carbon dioxide has saturated the planet before, raising temperatures. An acidic sea has led to profound changes in life on the planet before. A meteor may have unleashed a mammoth cloud of ash and dust that led to the demise of most dinosaurs. That's because the Earth is dynamic, ever-changing. The writer Craig Childs argues in his new book, Apocalyptic Planet, that understanding the range of this planet's extremes might help humans understand and prepare for the coming changes triggered by greenhouse gases. He traveled to places where seas boil, ice melts, species vanish, cataclysm strikes, and he started us in a spreading desert in Mexico.
It's in northwest Sonora, Mexico, on the mainland side across from Baja, and it's about 3,000 square miles of sand dunes sitting on the west side of a big big volcano, a dormant volcano. And, you know, some of the dunes are 400, 500, 600 feet high. Some are 800 feet tall. It's just this elegant landscape of sand just blowing and forming these ripples and fins. It's really an incredible place.
How did
to
we
just
end,
walk around?
How did we end up with a 3,000 square mile foot sand dunes and desert right there?
Well, it's all Colorado River sediment that's washed down. So, you know, for me, it's a very symbolic landscape because it's my home territory in the Southwest, reduced to sand grains and driven down to the Delta and then blown across the desert. So it's this really fine sand. It's like walking through silk. It's really an amazing landscape.
In hiking into it, you hiked across some areas that had been ranched. You even hiked across and stubbed your foot on a fence post. What happened to the people that were trying to settle that area?
Well, when we were there, it was 7 years into a pretty serious drought. And you know, drought cycles have come and gone through there. And it was a harsh time. You know, the ranch was abandoned, dead livestock all over the place, horses, cows, just scattered out over miles. And so it was dead. People had vanished. You know, probably some had gone to the States or, you know, they were living out in towns at the edge of this place. But it didn't look like people had been there for a while.
How dead was it? What living things did you encounter?
You know, that trip, there wasn't a lot. There were these black beetles called pinacate beetles. And we'd see them on occasion. And you know, for a while, there were two ravens that were following us. I didn't write about the ravens, but they would come out every day, and we'd watch them fly from miles away, you know, just specks on the horizon. And they would come and circle us, and we were walking with, you know, 100-pound packs full of water, just setting caches out there in the sand. And, you know, I couldn't tell if they were just coming out to see how we were doing, if we were ready to expire, if their meal was finished, or if they were just curious about what we were doing out there. But ravens and beetles, not much else.
And glassy scorpions.
Oh, yeah, scorpions. I forgot. Yeah, they would show up every now and then because we would, to get out of the heat, to get out of the sun, we ended up burying ourselves in sand every day. And, you know, we're just, our faces are sticking out from a dune slope. And we were finding that if we got close to these bunches of half-alive vegetation, Mormon tea plants growing out in the sand, that there were scorpions in the sand around it. So when we'd crawl out of the sand, a scorpion or two would fall out from us.
You and your friend Devin hiked into this area wanting to experience it, but you'd also, I guess, seen it from the air or from satellite photos. You called them star dunes. What were they like?
Yeah, just these magnificent dunes that are like mountains in themselves. They have they basically look like a starfish, an 800-foot-tall starfish, where the arms are these dune crests radiating off in all directions. Just amazing. The wind is sculpting them so that every facet is scalloped. Beautiful, beautiful sand forms.
Craig Childs has written what he calls a field guide to the ever-ending Earth, apocalyptic planet. He traveled to some of the extreme places on Earth in order to understand what, Craig Childs?
In order to understand what the end is, this thing that we are always talking about, the coming apocalypse, I wanted to kind of break it apart and say, well, it's not quite what we think. We have this idea of the apocalypse being this flash of light, this sudden ending, and everything's over. I'm looking at Earth's history and saying, okay, well, when did that happen? When were there these huge changes? And I come to realize, oh, it's not that it's this sudden moment. It's more of a process, that the end is a mosaic of events. You know, while parts of systems are decaying and collapsing, other parts are rising. So it's not quite as clear cut as one might imagine. And I guess I'm coming to this subject saying, hey, this Earth is unstable. It easily tips over into an equilibrium that is not favorable at all to the lives we live and most of the species live on Earth. But also to say that this time we're in now is just amazing. It's an incredible time in Earth's history, and it's a delicate time. It can easily be bumped out and replaced with something entirely different.
If I were taking the long term like that, and I was somebody who was being asked to consider the questions of climate change and human impact on climate change, I would say, look, in the long term, this is how the planet operates. Why focus our attentions right now on whether I'm driving my car one more mile or not?
Well, because we don't live in the long term. I mean, we live, 70-100 year lives, and we live in these shorter periods where we can actually see the change. That, yeah, if you come back in 10 million years, everything's going to look just fine. I mean, I'm looking at the extinction rates right now, and based on past mass extinctions in Earth's history, it takes, between 5 and 10 million years for biodiversity to return. And you can take that point of view and say, oh, it's going to be fine, and it will be fine. The Earth will absolutely be good with, it will recover. But, we don't have 5 to 10 million years. We live in these shorter spans, and we are affecting things that are right in front of us. So I'm trying to show both perspectives at the same time to say there is this hope. There is this longer future that the Earth is resilient, that it has seen much worse than what it is seeing now. But I think my point is that we haven't seen much worse. The species that are around haven't seen much worse than what is going on now. So what is happening now does really matter, because this is where we live.
Of course, you, Craig Childs, you write about, it doesn't necessarily have to come back, does it? You write about Mars losing its atmosphere, stripped away. You write about how the moon is up there protecting us from the ravages of asteroids and meteors. If it wasn't there, asteroids and meteors could still come down and have amazing impact. So it doesn't necessarily come back.
Right, it doesn't necessarily. There is a certain fragility if you take it all the way out. If there are events that could permanently remove most life on the Earth, and whether we can do that as a species, I'm not sure if we have that power just yet. We may not be terribly far from that. So there is the potential for just cataclysmic future for this planet. I'm hoping not, of course. I'm looking at the past and going, well, even the most cataclysmic things that have happened on Earth, the planet has come back, the planet as we recognize it. It's come back from 90% species loss and then returned to a thriving Earth. And that's what I'm hoping for. It seems less likely that something truly, truly cataclysmic that stands out in the entire history of the planet could happen. But that possibility is out there.
Craig Childs has written about some of those possibilities or the realities on our planet, Field Guide for the Ever-Ending Earth, Apocalyptic Planet. So you went to Greenland to look at cold and cold returns. What do you remember most about the Greenland cold?
Wind. A lot of wind. Just constantly streaming across the ice sheet, and just how, writing in my journal, I'd have about 5 seconds at a time to pull my hand out from my mitten and scribble before it felt like my hand was on fire and I'd have to jam it back in. I just remember that intense wind, and you're not sure if that's the feeling of frostbite starting on your cheeks, or it's just all the tiny grains of snow that are blowing by. I just remember the howling all night inside of your little tent, and the tent is getting smaller and smaller all night long because snow is building up around it, and it sounds like you're in the riggings of a tall ship. Just the during a windstorm, it's it fills your senses.
Who'd you go there with?
The head of the research camp was Conrad Steffen, who's one of the lead authors for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, And there were five other researchers out there too. And we flew out and set up shop and checked weather stations and GPS stations and at night talked about the future of the Earth.
You convince friends to go with you on some of these trips, or they convince you to come.
Right.
You and your friends are extremophiles, just like some of the creatures you write about. I mean, you guys hiking across the lava in Hawaii. Describe that experience, and when you noticed you were burning your boots.
Oh yeah, that's an amazing place because you're walking on ground that is days old, sometimes just one day old. I remember being there with a friend, a photographer, and we were walking across this black plain. We had left our camp behind, and we were walking across this cracked surface at night where every crack underneath us was glowing. So it had been molten the night before, and you can't stand on one foot for very long. You have to keep moving, and everything is glassy and crunching, and then, you know, there are rivers of live lava that are coming from ahead of us, just these lobes that are creeping along the ground and hissing and crackling, and it just sounds like sheet metal being dragged around. Just an incredible landscape because it's being born right in front of you. It is live molten steel coming out of the ground.
When you went there, you also went into some of those areas, kapukus, right? Where the lava has flowed around an area, and that area becomes an island, but also a sanctuary for natural native life.
Yeah.
Are you giving me a metaphor for how you think the Earth abides and survives over the millennia?
Yeah, definitely. That's actually what I hung a lot of this book on, at least in my mind, are these kapukas, these little remnants. And that's where, you know, when the lava cools, spiders come out of the kapukas and they start building webs and seeds blow out and fern spores get lodged in the cracks, and the kapukas start expanding again. They become the source of the future after a destructive event. And you know, of course, I'm looking at that and saying, well, these are wildlife refuges, you know, in a bigger sense, that wherever we're protecting places, they are our kapukas, that humanity is a lava flow that's moving around places and just consuming habitats and changing climates. And so I'm talking about preserving habitats, preserving climates even, you know, holding on to what is there, because that is a seed for the future.
Well, it's an extreme Earth you write about, but that's the Earth. You write about droughts. You also write about how civilizations fall and fail. How are civilizations preserved in those sanctuaries, do you think?
You know, I see it much the same way that, you know, preserving languages, preserving stories, preserving architecture, infrastructure, culture, they're, you know, civilization is made up of so many pieces, and it's easy to lose them. I mean, I'm writing about the decay of infrastructure here, you know, both, you know, looking at Mayans, looking at early Pueblo history in the Southwest, looking at Rome. My main example in this book is Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm watching the process of how that city is held together, and I guess I'm holding on to the old stories when I'm there. I'm saying, okay, well, there was a civilization before this, and there are still connections to that. There are still family names, you know, among the Hopi who remember this older history. So there are many different ways of holding on to a civilization.
Craig Child's book is Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Ending Earth. Is there any place you didn't get to go that you think also exemplifies this ever-changing, ever-ending Earth that you want to go to now?
Yeah, you know, locally, I had really wanted to go up onto Mount St. Helens to look at the blast zone up there and wander around and just, you know, look at succession, look at the plants that are coming back in, but also look at the devastation that occurred at that moment, you know, as just a small example of what's possible. I had really wanted to go down to the South Pacific. I thought that sounded great. get down there on, I was hoping to get dropped off on some kind of sand spit out in the middle of nowhere. I chose an island in the Bering Sea instead, but I'd still like to go down there. Lake Chad was on my list, the Aral Sea in Central Asia. There, this book was more a process of omission than anything.
Well, that's the Earth, right? Everywhere is a surprise.
Right, right. You can't go anywhere without being just bowled over by it.
Craig Childs is an award-winning writer and commentator. Apocalyptic Planet, Field Guide to the Ever-Changing Earth is his latest book.
Good morning, it's 10:35. I'm Andy Hurst. Depending on the outcome of R-74, Washington could become the seventh state to legalize same-sex marriage. Meanwhile, openly gay characters have become relatively common on TV. According to some, television is far ahead of the cultural curve. Later today, we'll talk it over with TV expert and professor Robert Thompson. He sits down with KUOW's David Hyde this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Asian Art Museum, presenting the lecture Painting Sita's Garden, Mithila Artists Portray Their Lives, with anthropologist Carolyn Brown Hines. October 25th at 7 p.m. Information at seattleartmuseum.org/gardenercenter.
You miss out on life for years and years, and then you meet the guy across the street who thinks you're a genius and you've got money again and love.
Acting on Impulse, this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
And that comes your way tonight at 10 o'clock. We have cloudy skies and a little bit of sunshine in Seattle, 49 degrees in the University District, working towards a high today of 51. The forecast calls for clouds and showers with a chance of thunderstorms and hail later today. Clouds and showers tonight, chance of thunderstorms and hail as well, the low near 40. Clouds and rain tomorrow, the high reaching 51.
That's right, Marty Wingate. Clouds and hail. Didn't you see the hail the other day?
Just because I wanted it to start raining doesn't mean we need hail.
Well, thanks a lot for that. Marty Wingate writes about gardens and travel and wishes for rain at martywingate.com. She's written a book, Landscaping for Privacy. She's here as part of our gardening panel to talk about, the wet garden and what you should do about it, what you might think about it. Also with her is Greg Rayburn, Vashon Basin Steward, works on habitat restoration and salmon recovery on Vashon and Maury Islands for King County. Hail.
All right.
You're ready for it.
Yeah.
Well, fine. Let's see if Willie Galloway is. Willie Galloway is host of the gardening and cooking website, digginfood.com. She's written a book, Grow, Cook, Eat. She joins us. Hello, Willie. Hail.
Hello. No thanks.
No thanks. Did you get hail in Portland?
We did not.
We had a nice little round of hail on Sunday.
Oh. Well, we had some, like, a pop of, you know, like, tons of rain, really hard.
Huh. So what did that do to your garden? Guess that took away your green tomatoes.
Yeah, I had to pull those out this weekend, and it kind of flattened some stuff that was getting weak. So, yeah, the garden's looking a little bedraggled at the moment.
You, Greg Rayburn, having a natural native plant garden, they probably didn't mind the hail at all.
No, everything's doing pretty well right now, although everything dried out pretty good. So, but this, now that the rains are here, that's, and the colder temperatures, that brings us to native plant salvage weather.
Yeah.
We have our first event coming up November 3rd out by Black Diamond, and I'll post a link on the Facebook page, but you can also just use a search engine and search for King County Native Plant Salvage.
Just a reminder, those happen where development is happening.
Yeah, so there's when sites are scheduled to be cleared for development and they have their permits and are good to go, then groups of volunteers go out to these sites and they're armed with shovels and heads up and burlap sacks, head off into the woods and dig up plants that were going to be bulldozed.
Does anybody ever find it ironic, the people who are getting the permits in particular, that they are scraping off the native vegetation in order to plant some houses and then will much later. I mean, does anyone in that system get the irony of that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's one thing that they can do as when they're developing the property to contribute towards habitat restoration. I mean, if it has to be cleared, then at least these plants aren't going to go to waste. Although after we do a salvage, it's not like we've taken every plant off, because we have to salvage small enough plants we can move them.
Yeah, you're not taking the big old cedar trees.
Exactly. But it is, it's an eye-opener, I think, for some developers when I've seen them out there collecting amphibians and saying, oh, now what do we do with them? Well,
nope, nothing.
Not much you can do.
Build a little house for them.
Yeah.
But
it is neat to see the volunteers out there. And one thing that's as a reward for the volunteers that participate in the program, they dig for the salvage program for the first few hours. Then they get to stay after and dig additional plants for themselves. So it is really neat to see all these native plants going off and thinking about, we'll have 50, 60, 100 people out there. And those are 50, 60, or 100 people that whose yards are being transformed from no habitat value potentially to just lawn to native plantings.
Right, from when they were transformed from native habitat to lawn.
Exactly.
Okay. That's good. That's what makes it such a great program, that it exists. What happened to your garden?
Well,
what are you doing now?
We're in a transition period for hummingbirds in our gardens, because the summer plants that have been blooming, the hardy fuchsias, the what they call the California fuchsia. We have a big pot of Zauchneria in back. And the clematis that I still have blooming, the hummingbird is still coming to those, but they are petering out. And I was out checking we have an Asian Mahonia. We also have native Mahonia that blooms in the spring, but the Asian Mahonia often blooms in fall and winter. So I was out looking at the fingers of flower stems forming on three or four different branches of this. So that'll be blooming in November, late November, and into December. So
the hummingbirds.
Yes.
I think we've heard different things on this, but this is my understanding. The ones that are here, some stay, but some may go further south, and then we may get ones from north who decide this is warm enough to hang out.
Well, okay. It's
what have you
the
heard?
Hummingbird that we have over the winter is the Anna's hummingbird. And so I don't know where they've been. Is that like the robins? Because the robins we get in December and January are not the robins that we have in the summer. So, okay. I'll take that.
Somebody will explain it even more to us.
Yeah.
Our number is 206-543-5869. If you are looking out at your garden and wondering what plans to make next, or if you're getting excited about what to plant now, maybe you have some questions or some comments. 1-800-289-5869. 206-543-5869. Give us a call. Lines open. You can also email us weekday@kuow.org. And you can also post on the Facebook page, KUOW Green Days. Search for that and you will find it. Willie, what are you planning now for your, are you just planning to mulch and maybe put a few more garlics in, or what are your plan now for your food garden?
Yeah, I need to plant some garlic. I have some beets, carrots, and leeks that I'm just going to be harvesting as I need them. So I'm leaving them in the ground. I'm not going to pull them out and store them inside. I'm just storing them in the garden. So I've got straw kind of piled up around them to kind of protect them from getting super soggy. So I'll be pulling those. Speaking of hummingbirds, I planted a lot of fruit sages this year, which are sometimes hardy, sometimes not, depending on our winter. But they typically will bloom all the way into November until it frosts. So I've had a lot of hummingbirds on my fruit sages, which is really fun to see because they're right outside my kitchen window.
What's a fruit sage?
Pineapple sage is
one. Oh, I see.
They have that scent to them. I love pineapple sage. It never lives over the winter for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there anything you can do to help it live over the winter, Willie, or even bloom a little longer?
to help it, I've had several live over the winter in a spot at my house in West Seattle when I lived in Seattle that was faced west, was near the house, and had really well-draining soil. So it was in a warmer kind of microclimate, and the thing that really gets them, I think, more than the cold is the really wet soil. So well-draining soil is good. And, you know, sometimes they live and sometimes they don't. And sometimes you think they're dead and then they come back, but late, like at the end of May. So sometimes I think people think their sage is dead, their pineapple sage, or if they grew another fruit sage, and they're not dead. They're just slow.
And then
but sometimes they are dead.
Yeah, and sometimes in late May when you see a few little tiny leaves at the base of it and you take a look at the one that you've had in your pot and it has got three microscopic leaves, and you can compare that to the gallon size plant at the nursery that you could buy in late May. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to resist the one that actually looks good.
Well, does the one with the small leaves eventually in our climate grow out and leaf out to some...
In my experience, it does, but it's definitely slower. And, you know, especially because you can plant fruit sages in late April or May once the frost has kind of stopped. And so, and they grow fast, really fast. I put some 4-inch containers in this spring, and the plants are like 3 feet across at the moment. So they are vigorous growers. So if you want to treat them as an annual, you can.
Our number is 206-543-5869, by the way. Join this conversation if you have some questions. We got some lines open. Also, you can email us weekday@kuow.org. Sean in Ballard writes, is it too late to plant clover as a cover crop for this winter? Is it too late for that, Willie?
Yes.
Too late. Is there anything else? Is there anything else that he can plant, Greg, at this point?
Well, you might want to go with a non-growing...
That kind of cover crop.
Yeah. I mean, going with spreading out a mulch like straw or leaves, compost, something like that instead.
Okay. Peter writes, I have four large ceramic outdoor containers, each with a dwarf banana, and would like to try to overwinter these. The containers receive full western exposure and are sheltered somewhat. What do you suggest to overwinter? I have to assume he has not overwintered them before.
Large containers, really large. The larger, the better. where does he live?
He says they're facing a nice.
They're facing west, but
west. Where is he? Lives on Beacon Hill.
Oh, Beacon Hill. Well, you know, it's quite possible. It's too bad that they're not facing west and they're up against the house. Perhaps a hand truck could help edge them closer to a protected place.
I mean, we have seen some folks manage to overwinter.
Yeah, and some people will cover their bananas so that the rain doesn't get right into the center of the growing point and rot it out. So they'll cover it with various and sundry layers of burlap and stuff and wrap them. And then come spring, when you take all that off, they look terrible, but they're alive. Huh. And then they recover.
All right. That's a good thing. How long can I leave my green tomatoes on the vine to ripen? Do you have still green tomatoes on the vine, Greg?
Yes, but that's because their plants are pretty much toast at this point. I just haven't got to that task yet.
Well,
I'm not trying to salvage anything at this point.
You're not going
to.
What do you think, Willie? I mean, can they, the plants are toast, the tomatoes are still green.
I would pick them as soon as possible. It's getting really chilly at night. And you don't want to have any cold damage on the tomatoes. Like I pulled out my tomatoes on Sunday and I thought there were some red tomatoes that I thought I'd pick and bring inside, and they had cracked and were starting to rot, you know. So get the tomatoes, pick them off the plant, or if you want to try the upside down method where you pull the whole plant out of the ground and pick off all the leaves and hang them in your garage, you can do that too. I think it's sort of easier to just pick the ones you want and bring them inside, and just put a piece of newspaper out on like a cardboard flat, like soda comes in, and put them in that and put them in a warm spot, and they'll ripen up.
And hope for the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if I can prune back my hydrangeas now. Samantha writes, I did a little online research that told me it was best to leave the blooms until spring. Is this true here in the Northwest?
Well, it would be better to wait, only because who knows, we may get this bit of warm weather in the winter and your hydrangeas will want to leaf out and then they'll be frozen if we get some more cold weather. And it's not bad to look out and see hydrangeas that have dried flowers on the top of them. That's all right.
My wife and I are buying a home that's in Mill Creek, and it's in the middle of some very large trees. The entire neighborhood is densely forested. There isn't much sun coming through. The house we currently live at is in the full sun, and I love to grow veggies there. Corn, cucumbers, peas, beans, which is a new plant that you haven't had.
It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid. What can I expect to grow in a full shade garden? None of those vegetables, right? Right.
Sounds to me like he needs to join a community garden. There's not a lot of edibles that will grow in full shade. In fact, there's pretty much none.
Although with native berries, you can go that direction, and things like evergreen huckleberry will grow fine there, red huckleberry, Oregon grape is another one. So,
do you make Oregon? Go ahead, Willie.
I was going to say, I went to my book club last in September, and a woman in my book club brought sorbet that she made with Oregon grape.
Yeah.
And it was delicious.
Well, that sounds nice.
I was super impressed.
Oh, that's nice, Willie. That sounds great. That's what I was wondering. Have you ever done that? Have you made Oregon grape out of any of the grapes?
No, I haven't.
All right. I want to try that. I would like to. By the way, we're going to drive out to Mill Creek to talk to some voters. So if any Mill Creekians want to tell us where we should go to find some good undecided or middle-of-the-road voters, email weekday at KOW, and we'll come dropping by, talk to you. You know, and if it's you and you're home, by all means, let us know. Otherwise, we're just going to wander aimlessly through the streets and knock on doors. One more email and then one call here, too. The plant I have, Julia writes, which I recommend to every wet side gardener without reservation, and which the Anna hummingbirds love, is the Pink Dawn viburnum, which typically blooms from Labor Day until at least Easter, with a peak in January. Witch hazels are good, too, especially the red variety, Diane. Do you have the Pink Dawn?
You have that viburnum, Steve.
Well, it doesn't bloom at Labor Day.
Mine doesn't start quite that early, but it
that's Bodendent.
Yes, Bodendentense.
Yeah, thank you, Bodendentense.
It puts out flowers throughout the late fall and winter anyway, and into spring. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, they do like that. But I wish it did start at Labor Day.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But it does go till Easter, that's for sure. Mm. And it smells great.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great plant. All right, Anna's in Roanoke. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I have asparagus plants in my yard, and some of them have apparently seeded, and I have little volunteer asparagus plants growing around. Should I just throw them out, or can I consolidate them and put them in a special spot? And if so, when should I do that?
Hmm. Asparagus. Who wants to take asparagus? Willie, you want asparagus?
Yeah, I would probably dig those guys up, and just because it takes them a long time to develop their root system where then spears emerge. That's why typically when you buy asparagus, you buy a crown, which is an established root system. So if you want more asparagus, I would buy crowns. The other reason why is asparagus have male and female plants, and the male plants are much more productive. So you would probably be uncertain as to what was what. And so I would, if you want to expand your asparagus patch in about February when the bare root asparagus crowns are available, I'd buy more.
All right, great. Anna, thank you. I have some new camellias on my deck in Port Orchard, some nice blooms in this big pot, doing fine. Do I need to bring this baby into the house for the winter? It's very healthy and the deck is covered.
Oh, gosh, no. Camellias are hardy in our climate.
When do I withdraw water from non-hardy fuchsias, tuberous begonias, other tips? That's another email question.
Well, if you are taking your non-hardy fuchsia and your begonias indoors, then you probably want to do it. A little frost wouldn't hurt them, but you don't want a hard freeze because they're probably in containers. My non-hardy fuchsias will overwinter If I stick them, I leave them outside. But of course, you know, we're in Seattle. And I've stuck them under the deck before, just somewhere where they won't be drenched, but they're protected. And they do leaf out, and I do keep those.
They don't like to be drenched, but otherwise they can handle the colder weather.
Well, they don't want, the whole thing won't freeze. And if it does, then they're gone. But people will take their fuchsias downstairs into the unheated basement or in the garage. Big tuberous begonias, you can save those. You can save them in dry soil. Do you have those?
I don't yeah. protect anything.
You don't?
if it can't survive outside over winter.
I don't take anything in either, but people do, and that's how they survive, and you can just leave them dormant through the winter. The fuchsia you may want to water very occasionally. The tuberous begonias, these big corm-like things, you don't have to do anything to.
Greg is a ruthless gardener.
He is.
I like to invest in things that survive easily.
Hence the native plants.
Yes.
I've been told your pumpkins and squashes are useless to provide seeds for next year's planting because they've been pollinated willy-nilly by bees and the seeds will produce mongrels not worth cultivating. Comments? That's from Ricardo. Comments on that, Willie?
Yeah. it kind of depends. If you just had one kind of squash in your garden and you're pretty sure none of your neighbors were growing squash, you know, it's possible that it's just the same variety that you're going to get. The other thing is that a lot of squash plants are hybrids, so you don't want to save the seed from them because you're not going to get the same seed anyways. So that said, I've had mystery pumpkins before. One time we just dumped our jack-o'-lantern over the side of and some other squash that we'd been using for decoration on our deck, and it just sort of rotted in the flower bed. And then we got pumpkins next year that were actually really good. but I think that was just good luck. So yeah, if you want to have a specific variety, you either need to take steps to save seeds, and it's pretty easy to do that. You can find instructions online to save squash seeds and make sure they're not cross-pollinated, or you just need to buy new seed next year.
Yeah, that was pretty good luck she had, don't you think, to actually get the pumpkins?
Yeah.
Good pumpkins, yes.
But if you're going to carve them anyway, that's their purpose.
I mean, you do get something, even if they are, as he put it, mongrels. You do get mm-hmm. something, right?
Yeah.
And that's always interesting.
It's always an adventure.
All right, last email question here. Are there any bulbs to plant bright to medium shade? Must be lots. Bright to medium shade.
Bright shade, you could use snowdrops. A lot of crocus will bloom in bright shade. Hardy cyclamen, which of course they bloom either in the fall or in winter, and they have lovely foliage until summer when they go dormant. You can put carpets of them under shrubs and trees. They look fabulous, but it's not the spring show that you might be thinking of.
Hmm. All right. Anything you want to add?
Trilliums.
There you are.
All right then. Anything you want to add, Willie, just in general?
I thought they were talking about a medium shade color. I was like, well, gosh, there's lots of options.
yes. All right. Yeah. We will consider the medium shades next week as well with Willie Weir, with Willie Galloway. You'll see why I said that, though, in a minute. With Willie Galloway, with Greg Rayburn, with Marty Wingate, when we talk about gardening. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
And our bicycling correspondent, Willie Weir, he's in Bangkok. He's making his way up to Myanmar. He and his wife Kat. So he sent us the sound of the day. There's the sound of a guy who's outside a National Stadium SkyTrain stop, banging on plastic buckets, pieces of metal, and old Samsonite luggage. Willie Weir says that in the past, no matter where he traveled, he'd run into a Peruvian band playing in town squares and on city streets. He says they've been replaced by this new trend, which he calls guys banging on stuff. Plastic paint buckets, garbage cans, cowbell. They wail away on these items, usually with impressive results. And he put a picture of our drummer on our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. We'll get more sounds from him as he travels across Asia. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Amina Asadi. Andy Hirsch is our engineer, and we get help from Alexandra Garrettin and Danielle Anthony Goodwin. And I'm Steve Scherer. We shall talk to you tomorrow.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Science Center's Ancient Egypt Distinguished Speakers Series at Town Hall Seattle Tuesday evenings in October and November, an exploration of ancient Egypt including the curse of the pharaohs and the secrets of Tutankhamun's life and death. Details at pacificsciencecenter.org.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Fletcher, KUOW News. KUOW welcomes all the new and renewing members who participated in our recent membership drive. Thank you for making this drive so successful. When you get your pledge reminder in the mail, be sure to return it as soon as you can. And thanks again for all your support.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.